Opera Coeur d'Alene has a production of Mozart's The Magic Flute on the 11th and 13th of September. We had a nice time in the studio with a couple singers, the director and the conductor from this opera. Let's begin the conversation with tenor Vale Rideout, who sings the role of Tamino, and specifically how many times he's done this before.
I think it's my 10th production, and so far it's my favorite. So
nice.
So that's been the great thing about this visit.
Nice. Where are you living currently?
In Pennsylvania, northeast Pennsylvania, near Allentown.
Okay, and then going out on the road and singing opera where and when you can?
Yes, that's the goal. I do have a one-year-old baby girl that now changes that equation and what it does. But yes, I even though I miss my girls, I do have to get out, and I enjoy, you know, performing. It's part of just, it's in my blood, so.
Well, we're going to hear you sing Tamino's aria, in which he's carrying his flute around. How do you want to, on the way even into singing it for us, how do you want to describe Tamino? Is he so innocent that he doesn't get it, or is he so pure? What's Tamino's character, and what are maybe some of the different ranges of how you can describe Tamino?
Well, I think Tamino, you know, on his face, I mean, he's a prince. So he has certain qualities with a prince. He's, you know, young, a young person of power and status, of course. He has qualities to him that work in his favor later on in his trials in the opera. But he has a naivete that allow him to stay in the journey and discover the strange characters that are in front of him, such as Papageno, such as the Queen of the Night, the three ladies that come in. There's a lot of strangeness in this world that he is seeing, and he, I think, is naive enough to kind of be able to learn and be able to be molded and not just be a prideful prince. So it's an interesting character that isn't quite as simple as you might think.
So the end of innocence?
Yes, perhaps the furthering of it. I mean, you know, the other princes I always think of in at least my world are the princes in Into the Woods, which are much more cardboard. They're much more, it's the prince is very, you know, very cocky, very, you know, very self-sure. Tamino's, it's much more complex than that. In many ways, and you know, good and bad, but really, it ends up being the aspects to his character which allow him to achieve the greatness that in the end Zarathustra. Sorry, spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. That Zarathustra challenges him to find.
And so, the aria you're about to sing. What are you saying in this aria?
Well, he has gone through various ups and downs, and thinks that he has. He's now going to achieve going to find love with Pamina, and this is the first time that he actually tests out the magic flute and hears its music and sees its power and what it can do. So
good. Well, let's send you in to sing that aria. This is the first of our two singers, Vale Rideout, in the role of Tamino. Celeste Johnson at the piano, and they will be singing this aria from the magic flute.
Zauberton, weil alle Flöte und Flöte durch dein Spielen selbst bildet ihre Freude fühlen. Wie stark ist nicht dein Zauberton? Weil alle Flöte spielen. Holde Flöte durch dein Spielen, selbst bildet ihre Freude. Doch nur Pamina, nur Pamina bleibt davon, nur Pamina bleibt davon. Pamina, Pamina. Vielleicht sei er Pamina schon, vielleicht eilt sie mit ihm zu mir, vielleicht, vielleicht führt mich der Ton zu ihr, führt mich der Ton zu ihr, führt mich der Ton, der Ton, der Ton zu ihr.
From the Magic Flute, Tamino's aria, in which he's discovering his magic flute, sung in our studio by the gentleman playing the role of Tamino in this upcoming magic flute performance, Veil Rideout, and joined by the pianist Celeste Johnson. Well, let's straight away meet the person in the role of Pamina, Ann Carolyn Bird. Good morning, Ann Carolyn.
Good morning, how are you?
And let's get kind of right into who you are and what you do when you're not right here in Spokane performing.
Well, this is an interesting time in my personal and professional life. My husband, Matthew Burns, is also a cast member. He's singing Papageno. And the reason he couldn't be here with us today is because he is back at our place taking care of our two children. And the four of us are living on the road this year. We have gigs all over the country, and it just didn't make sense to keep our apartment in New York any longer, and so we are traveling all around.
Opera gypsies.
We are opera gypsies, absolutely.
Wow.
And, for me, I actually lived in Seattle in a previous chapter of my life, and have a grandmother who lives in Colville, Washington, and I think she's listening now.
Mm.
Hi, Grandma Bird. and so it's great to be back in this part of the country. I love it. And I was raised an Air Force brat, so I'm just gypsy all over the place, but have a really, you know, exciting season coming up with my family. And it's hard to believe that this gig is work, because we have so many friends in the cast. Vale and Aaron and Matt and I have known each other for a long time, and we're just having a really good time working together.
Nice. How old are the kids that are joining you?
My son, Henry, is 5, and our daughter, Gloria, is 6 months.
Wow, and this is working. Your gypsy life is working.
This is our first gig on the road, and I'll say the trip out here, the 9-day road trip from Richmond, Virginia to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, was a little more stressful than I anticipated. But,
a little like a Chevy Chase movie?
Yes, a little bit. But, you know, after we got here and got back on our feet, we've been having a great time, and from... You know, then we go to Omaha, and then we go to Washington, D.C., and so we'll see.
And Carolyn Burt? Bird?
Bird. Like
Bird.
A
Bird. And Carolyn Bird. In the role of Pamina. And so, again, Pamina, she's pretty conflicted, kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, isn't she?
She doesn't know it at the beginning, but it's, you know, you've talked about Tamino kind of coming into enlightenment, figuring out what's going on, what's really happening around him. And the same is true for Pamina. She has been raised by her mother, and you know, she believes everything that her mother told her, and then all of a sudden,
her mother being the queen of the night,
yes, and then all of a sudden she finds herself in Zarathustra's world and hearing different things about power and truth and goodness, and so she's having to figure out for herself which side am I on? What does this mean for me? She is a princess. I think she has seen much less of the world than Tamino has. And so it's all very new new for her. But she proves herself to be worthy, just as Tamino does. And they start, although she gets jerked around a little bit. She meets him and has to leave him three times before... before they get to be together.
Well, and in the tune you're about to sing, that's one of those points, yep. isn't it? Tell us a bit about Archifield.
Oh, it's a beautiful aria in which they met, they had to be separated, and she found him again, and she thought, okay, great, now we can finish this together, we can figure out what's going on together. But he has taken a vow of silence, and so he doesn't speak to her, and she is completely set adrift. She doesn't understand, and she thinks that it's over. She thinks her one hope of understanding her life and having a future is dashed, and now she feels, and even Papageno, who up until this point has been a bit of a blabbermouth, even he's not speaking to her. And so she really is lost, and she feels very alone, and you can hear it in the music. Mozart, we've said several times in rehearsal, you could just stand here and sing this and the audience would understand exactly what the character is feeling, because Mozart's music is just a magical communication.
Well, let's experience that right now. My guest, Anne Carolyn Bird, who is going to go into the studio and sing this kind of low point for Pamino's character, aria of Archifuels. So let's go back to our performing studio.
Thank you.
And Carolyn Bird singing that low point in the opera for Pamina, the aria Achic Fuels. Let's bring Eckhart Proy, conductor, in here, and he and Aaron Nicholson. Let's kind of take on this whole subject, and especially from your European background, Eckhart, of magic flute is fun, easy, light, silly entertainment versus what sense of depth and deep meaning we want to get out of. Is there a conflict there? Does it work both ways?
I think that's the amazing thing about Mozart, that he can do both, and you don't see it coming, and you don't feel the transition. And actually, looking at the piece again, I was surprised how funny it actually is, how much humor there is, and how, not harmonically, but also in terms of articulation, a little accents here and there, but also how he uses language. It's just phenomenal. I mean, it's a literally endless resource of fun in there. But when it gets dramatic, like the aria we just heard, then it gets really, really, really dramatic and really sad. And there's some really tense moments, and shocking moments even. But they only work because everything else is kind of it's almost goofy. And I'm not quite sure if we're actually allowed to be goofy with Mozart, because he's such a saint, you know. And so there's a little hesitation there at first. But then at the end, you know, he was a goofball himself, I think.
Yeah. And so, Aaron Nicholson, have you felt any constraint on being goofy?
No constraints on being goofy. I think that that Eckhart has hit it right on the head, and he was composing a fantasy, and so he could go further, I think, in both directions than typically maybe. But you could even say in Così and Nozze he does the same thing to an extent. But he's given with his partner Schikaneder in this instance the ability to push the envelope, which I think was his want to do. You hear it in the voices, you hear it in many aspects of the music. So we get the opportunity to push the fantasy as far as possible, and then push what is the human strains that we all recognize. We get to push those as far as we want to as well, and that's what we're attempting to do with our production.
Yeah. One quick prosaic question: how do you deal with the long parts of dialogue within this opera? Because you're doing the opera in German, and what do you do with the dialogue?
Dialogue's in English.
Okay.
And it's cut significantly. I've done the production myself numerous times, and a lot of it, the humor is sort of 200 years old, and so just cutting, as Eckhart likes to say, and so there's significant cuts in the dialogue that don't really add necessarily too much to our production in particular, but also to a production that happens now, as opposed to a production that happened 200 years ago.
And Eckhart, you've spoken before just about your love of opera, your desire to do opera. So talk a little bit about your involvement and engagement in this project.
Well, you know, as a symphony orchestra, we don't really get to do much opera. Mm-hmm. And so we're really lucky to have the Coeur d'Alene Opera Company here right next door, because what Aaron has done in the years that he's been here has really elevated it to a very high professional level. And it's just so much fun to see that, because we're all in the same boat. I mean, we're all here to promote classical music, and an opera is, for me, one of the greatest achievements, I think, of composers, and challenges also to do, I think, for everybody involved, because of the many aspects, you know, acting, singing, staging, sets and music, and being in the pit for the orchestra,
and ballet in this production.
I mean, it's just really bringing all the art forms together, you know, kind of in a Wagnerian sense almost. And that's just really a lot of fun, and it needs a lot of flexibility, and it's always an adventure. And working on the same thing. I mean, you know, Aaron, as a director, prepares himself for what he wants to do. I prepare myself for what I want to do, and then we just hope that we're on the same boat, and we just happen to be in the same boat. And that is really, really great to see. And that's also why we'll do this again, and that's also why we are at Spokane Symphony collaborating with the Coeur d'Alene Opera.
Talk about the reverse, essentially.
Well, I don't know if it's a reverse. the Spokane Symphony, last time we did opera on stage, staged, was probably 10 years ago with Rigoletto. And an opera is a very expensive enterprise. And so we are, as a regional orchestra, not able to kind of pull that off on our own. And so the idea was to bring in this great opera company right next door and do a collaboration on something that our audience would love. And we came up with La Bohème, which will be staged. The orchestra will be also on stage. And so there's going to be a lot of interesting things going on there on stage. We're going to do a lot of with lighting, I'm sure. And the singer is going to be actually in front of the stage, and the orchestra is going to be in the middle. So it's going to be a really phenomenal production. But it's as much fun, actually more fun almost for me being at the pit. I mean, being really in the orchestra pit validates you in many ways as a conductor. You can actually prove your usefulness. Well, when you have a good symphony orchestra, you have a Mozart symphony. You just give that an downbeat; they're just going to do it on their own.
And in the European tradition, isn't intense opera training part of the way you're brought up and the
That's
way
how you learn it. That's how you learn it. I mean, I did very very few symphonic works during my 5 years or so studying in Germany. Most of the time, you are prepared to be an opera conductor, both what you can do on the piano, but also the way you learn technique and what it takes. And your apprenticeships when you're being brought in to all these little opera companies that exist. It's all there to be an opera conductor.
In addition to the art, you also learn an awful lot of practicality of how to make anything work, don't you?
That's what it's all about. I mean, you know, if you really narrow it down to what is a conductor good for, it's basically just getting it started, keeping it together, and end together, and then everything else is on top of that. But in opera, it's really the very practicality of keeping everybody on the same page in performance, no matter what happens. And that's always something that happens, which I love about opera. That's always an accident. That's always someone who doesn't show or who misses the entrance or whatever happens, because there's so much going on. And I think that's what makes opera such a lively thing and also an adventure every time you do it.
Right. Yeah. Eckhart Proy, who will be conducting this performance on Friday and Sunday, the 11th and 13th. Of September. Thank you, Eckhart. Let's move back to the other people because
you
have places to go and things to do. And so back to you, Aaron Nicholson. You said that you're through all of the depth of this working really hard at making it family friendly, that you don't have to be an esoteric insider to come to this opera. What are some of the things you've done?
Well, it starts as a family friendly piece. I think that the idea of a Singspiel, a sung spoken piece, is basically the German 18th century equivalent of a musical theater, sort of bring the family to the opera. And so that's a great place to start from. I've done a couple other things to push that even a little bit further. This piece in particular has a significant amount of Masonic undertones and overtones, and they're very present. Even just in the overture that you played earlier, there's the symbolism of the three chords, and that's a magic number, a special number to the Masons, and there's the concept of the pyramid. Even takes place in Egypt, and has this kind of underpinning that rests on this Masonic tradition. And that's something I didn't feel like I needed to play up. It's something that only a few people can actually relate to in the first person. And although it adds mystery to the piece, it doesn't add a lot of dramatic energy. So I let that speak for itself. And I'm a big fantasy buff, and I love a lot of contemporary fantasy. I love Tolkien. I love C.S. Lewis. I love sci-fi fantasy as well. But I'm aiming towards sort of the Rowling, the Harry Potter, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Lord of the Rings, even the Game of Thrones. That sort of fantasy feel, and so it translates very easily because a lot of these characters were codified by Tolkien. And based on ancient German, tales and ancient English tales, and so fairies. We have a full corps de ballet of fairies that is staged during the overture, and then they help all through the entire piece, and they're an extra element to the piece. And Tamino, for instance, he comes in, he's basically sort of an older Harry Potter character. He's traveling from a regular world, a normal world, our world, to this other fantasy place, and he meets elves, and he meets tiny little Knibshan, little boy ghosts, and queens of the night, these demigods. The whole thing plays very, very easily into that concept. So that's where we've gone with this production as far as we can.
And at that point, I want to bring in the two singers to speak in an overview sense of singers. You learn your part, and you show up knowing the role, and you don't quite know what the vibe of the production is going to be till you walk in. So you can either be a specific here, or you can hide behind talking about someplace else or something. But how does this happen when you show up and you find, oh, I thought of the character this way, but then the director is taking the character that way? And what's your lifetime experience in that? Come a little closer to the mic.
Well, I think Vale might have more specific things to say. You're giving me the look of maybe not. But having sung Tamino, see, I did it too. Yeah. Tamino about 10 times, I'm sure he knows that feeling of you have a character that's very familiar to you. For me, that character would be Susanna in Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. I've performed that role 7 times. And so yes, you do get to know a character very well, but then you have to come in as much of a blank slate as possible. And there are some things that you come to really love and cherish about a character that you kind of hope, like, oh, I hope the director doesn't take that away, you know, or doesn't want that element there. And but if they do, you have to be flexible enough to do it, because while it is you on the stage giving the performance, the overall picture, the cohesive package that you're trying to present to the audience comes from the director, and so you have to find a way to make it work. Mm-hmm. I think we all agree that this production is exciting, and none of us have had any trouble getting into the fantasy world and finding the tropes that we want to use to find our characters. So,
Vale?
Yeah, you know, I have performed this role many times, and the surprising thing about this piece to me is that more directors don't take more chances with it. And I'm not speaking about this production specifically, because there's some really great stuff happening in this production. There's a vision that's really cohesive, really interesting, you know. But I guess I'm speaking of many productions of flute, which tend to be very traditional. And with a piece as fantastical as this, it's always surprising to me that there aren't more chances being taken, more ideas, more different angles on the relationships, the characters, the music, the world in which everybody lives. It's so rife for exploration. And I do love that we're doing that. We have some really fantastic ideas that Aaron's brought, and then Aaron's invited us as actors to explore and bring more of what we can to the role and to the relationships we have. And it's exciting, but it is our job. I mean, Anne Carolyn said it just right. It's our job as actors to come to a production and to find in ourselves and our performances the director's vision. And sometimes that's very difficult. Sometimes that's very easy. And it goes anywhere in between.
Yeah. And back to you, Aaron, about the whole production, the look of the production. Does it breathe in any sense a time period or even a place other than the kind of certain reference to Egypt? But how have you dealt with all that?
Well, we're not in Egypt. We're in we've come to a fantasy land that happens in the now.
Yeah. And so you're not in a diner in New York City.
Exactly. It's not a hotel in downtown in Manhattan. It's a fantasy world that has a lot of things that we may recognize. I do like the use of found objects in surprising ways. And so we're using things here and there that you would recognize from your own life, but are used in a different way in this world. And I'm not going to give away what those things are, but they're
so great.
You'll definitely find that you're exploring this world and finding little surprises as you go. It's not an overly overwrought set and concept. It's very light feeling. Although we've been rehearsing, to give you an idea, we have four periactoids basically that act as the set, and those are triangular columns, and they each have a surface, a different surface on them, and they rotate throughout the show to create different things. They're 28 feet tall. And so we can create a great vast spaces, and we can also create sort of claustrophobic spaces at the same time, which is I like the freedom of that. I'm excited about where we've put it. It's now. It feels current. It feels modern.
And you spoke of ballet. Is that the dragon jumping around, or how did you get ballet injected into this?
Well, I wanted to use a corps de ballet, and I happened to have one at my disposal. I mean, when you're in the art studio, you know, and you've got every color to paint with, why would you not use a color that's available to you? Or why would you say, I'm not going to use that color? And so often we don't get the opportunity, and my wife happens to run Ballet Coeur d'Alene. There's a pre-professional program within these amazing kids, and the recreational program is good as well. And so I said, why not? Let's use them. So they are... think Midsummer Night's Dream. Think The Tempest. They are inhabitants of the world, independent of the Queen of the Night's realm and independent of Zoroastro's King of the Day sort of vibe. They just live in this place. They're mischievous, and they help the characters make their way through. But sometimes they hinder the characters, and sometimes they bring out Papageno's ladder for the suicide. Or sometimes they have sort of a quality that is in between good and bad. And they just do... frankly, I was watching the fairy show with Tinkerbell with my daughter and thought, oh, that would be nice if I could incorporate that element. Mm. And so I started listening to the overture and thinking, how could I incorporate a full ballet into that? And then started finding all the pieces are very suited. And oftentimes they do use dancers. When I did the production at the Metropolitan Opera, the Julie Taymor production, they use dancers throughout the entire piece to be the creatures and that sort of a thing. And we do something similar, but it's a lot more fuller and a lot more balletic. Mm.
This is Opera Coeur d'Alene's production of Mozart's Magic Flute, and it's the Friday the 11th, Sunday the 13th of September. And the location?
It's at the North Idaho College Schuller Performing
Arts.
So
you have
Center.
That full Schuller Performing Arts auditorium to use the facility so that it'll all fit.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Aaron St. Clair Nicholson.
Thank you, Bert.
And Anne Carolyn Bird in the role of Tamino.
Thank you,
Anne. And Vale Rowdite, right out returning.